Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. It is Impeachment Day, and it's worth remembering this has only happened three times in American history, only twice in the last 150 years. And we are joined by Washington Post columnist Greg Sargent, who is one of our... I would describe you as an unabashed progressive, right, Greg? So welcome to the center-right.
Thank you very much. I like the center-right these days.
Okay, so we're waiting on the inevitable vote, and I have a number of things I want to talk about, including this remarkable letter that I am holding in my hand, six-page, single-space letter from the President of the United States, many exclamation points, talking about the very ugly word of impeachment. And I do think there's one thing that we ought to get clear. He's complaining that where is this line? He's complaining that the impeachment process that more due process was afforded to those accused in the Salem witch trials. And you know, a lot of people are saying, well, you know, the witches were burned in the Salem witch trials. Now, you know, Greg, right? There were no witches burned in the Salem witch trials. They were, in accordance with English law, 19 of them were taken to the infamous Gallow Hills to die by hanging. And the elderly Giles Corey was pressed to death with heavy stones after he refused to enter a plea, and a bunch of the other witches died in jail while awaiting a trial. So I just wanted to clarify that nobody was actually burned. So I'm looking at the Washington Post website, like the article right above yours right now, and interestingly enough, there's a piece by one of your colleagues saying that that in fact the last several weeks have been the most successful in Donald Trump's presidency. I'm guessing you see it differently.
Yeah, I don't see how anyone could seriously and in good faith look at the last few weeks and see them as good for Trump. Let's remember that we were bombarded by endless propaganda and lies from people like Brad Parscale and others in Trump's orbit about how much he was relishing this fight. Every day, it seems like Parscale tweets out some new set of fake numbers that supposedly show that the base is deeply energized by this. And look, the Republican base probably is energized by this, but revelation after revelation has come out here. And today's Washington Post poll, I thought, was a really key tell. 71% of Americans want to hear from Trump's top aides at the Senate trial, and 55% of Americans say that the House inquiry was fair. I mean, we can, you know, pretend that Trump actually has something persuasive in when he says fake polls and all the rest of it, but he doesn't, right? He doesn't have magical powers, and the public is firmly behind this process. I would like the impeachment and removal numbers to be a little higher, like in the 50s. But removal is a drastic step, and the country is just very different now than it was in the 1970s. And I think the fact that a plurality supports removal is also a key tell. This, combined with the recent elections we've seen, in which we've seen a genuine anti-Trump majority assert itself in very odd places, right, in deep red places, I can't imagine that they're feeling good.
Well, let me push back to you a little bit. Those national numbers show the country pretty evenly divided, but in Trump land, there is evidence that there's pushback, that independents are not necessarily backing this. And I think, by the way, that makes the decision by many of the House Democrats in the swing seats more courageous here. But you know, there is a line of punditry out there that the Democrats are blowing this, that there is going to be a backlash, that this is mobilizing the Trump base, they're raising huge amounts of money on it, and that, in fact, this is going to cost a bunch of Democratic seats in the House.
Well, let's just look at the most recent elections we had, right, in Kentucky and in Louisiana. Those are deep red states, and there was a very good analysis that I strongly recommend to everyone by David Wasserman, who looked at those two races and did a real deep dive into the numbers. And this is directly relevant to the point you're talking about. And what he found is that it's absolutely true that there's this real outpouring of turnout and a real shift towards Democrats in the suburbs, right? In the suburbs of Cincinnati and northern Kentucky and New Orleans and Virginia, too. Not just northern Virginia, but also around Richmond, right, which helped flip the state, the full control of the state legislature to Democrats. all this was unfolding while the impeachment inquiry was underway. And as Wasserman pointed out, you had that turnout and vote shift really high in Democrats' favor, but you also had juiced up turnout in the rural and exurban Trump areas in all these places. But it wasn't enough to overcome what we're seeing on the Democratic side. I strongly recommend that analysis.
No, it was an excellent analysis.
Yeah, and I think that speaks directly to your point. They're maxed out on their backlash. I think that this shows that. I would never predict that Trump isn't going to win re-election. I think he's at least 50% for re-election, mainly because of the Electoral College. I think we all anticipate him losing the popular vote potentially by more this time than last time. But the Electoral College is a real thing. A real problem for Democrats right now. Particularly with this guy. I was talking to the state chair of Wisconsin, Ben Wickler, who's a smart and hard-headed Democrat, serious data guy, organizational guy, and he conceded to me, and that interview is up on my blog if anyone wants to see it. It's an interesting interview. He was quite candid. He said, in essence, yes, when I pressed him on the question of how deep the pools of blue-collar white support really run, how deep these currents really run, he admitted, we don't know. So that's why, you know, we all have to admit that Trump is at least at 50% for re-election. We don't know in a state like Wisconsin, where I believe it's around 57% non-college educated white, isn't it?
That's right. So,
yeah, I think we don't know what the turnout could look like.
Right. And as you pointed out, I mean, the big story, you know, I mean, a lot of us had focused on the undervote in Milwaukee County, but the really big story is the loss of Democratic votes in rural Wisconsin, and we don't know whether there's farther to fall there. So let's look ahead to the Senate vote. Mitch McConnell basically saying he's rejecting Chuck Schumer's proposal to have witnesses. It certainly sounds like he would prefer not to have a trial with witnesses. What do you expect to happen now with the Senate?
Well, I just put up a piece that I hope people will look at. We found some video from 1999 in which Susan Collins said she absolutely, during the impeachment trial of Bill Clinton, in which Susan Collins said she absolutely needed witnesses and more evidence in order to get to the truth. And her office gave us a statement from her saying she hasn't made the decision on the witness thing. I would never underestimate Mitch McConnell's devious ability to get people to do the wrong thing in almost any circumstances in his own caucus. But in this case, you know, I don't know. I think there might be a bit of pressure on people like Susan Collins and Cory Gardner and Mick Sally in Arizona, which is, by the way, she's behind in a couple polls, right?
Well, you wrote a piece that the Democrats can put pressure on Republicans. They can put the Republicans on defense on this issue, and you only need a handful, a bipartisan group, to basically say, "Yeah, Mitch, we're not going along with your White House coordinated plan." Right? I mean, he needs to get 51 votes to pass the rules for impeachment.
I think that may be right. There's sort of some differences around this. I think if they stick to the 1999 precedent, what could end up happening is that, and this is what Schumer has called for in the letter that he wrote to McConnell, one way to do this would be to hold a Senate vote on the overall process. And that vote would be essentially something like, okay, you get to call X number of witnesses, we get to call X number of witnesses. Now let's have that vote right now. And if that got 51 senators, it would become the process. And then within that process, you could have vote after vote after vote, potentially, on each witness, or there'd be different ways to do it. I think there are other ways. If they don't reach an agreement and something doesn't pass, there may be other ways to use an even older precedent in which you would have senators potentially bring motions, and then you'd have votes on individual witnesses. It's very convoluted right now, but I kind of anticipate that they'll negotiate something. I think we're just seeing a lot of public posturing right now.
Are the Democrats paying a price for the speed with which they have undertaken this, not waiting to litigate the subpoenas, not putting more pressure on the White House to produce the witnesses? Because, of course, now we're going ahead and the pushback is, well, it's a little bit thin. I mean, I personally think they have enough evidence to impeach the president. I have no problem with that. But in terms of making the case, they've left so much on the table. There's no document. They never got any documentary evidence. The two articles of impeachment ignore the Mueller report. So where do you come down on all of that? I mean, I wrote a piece called, Two Cheers for the Articles of Impeachment, the two cheers not being the third cheer, because I think there's so much else, including the very clear evidence of obstruction of justice that was included in the Mueller report. So, have the Democrats, was this a smart thing for them to go fast and narrow and slim as opposed to more robust?
Well, let me say, I agree with you on the obstruction piece. I wanted a third article for obstruction for all kinds of reasons, one of which is that not doing that kind of seeds the field to William Barr to come in with his, invented narrative of what happened in 2016. And an article for obstruction would essentially put the Democratic House on record as saying that that Trump's efforts to cover up what happened in 2016 are also impeachable, all the lawbreaking that went into that. But so I agree with you on that. On the other piece of this, in terms of whether to keep fighting in court, I would have liked to see that. But I suspect that what's going on, and I don't have inside knowledge of this, although one Democratic aide sort of confirmed it to me, I think if it went on too long, you might see some of these moderates drop off. And I think that would be a real problem for Democrats, right? If one moderate and two moderates and three, well, four, or five.
This is the striking thing about this impeachment vote. There have been a lot of speculation that you were going to lose a lot of these moderates, people from the swing districts. And it makes sense if you have a district that Donald Trump won by 15 points, you might be reluctant to vote yes on this article of impeachment. Now, when you and I are speaking, we haven't actually had the vote, but it looks like Nancy Pelosi is going to lose only a tiny number of Democrats.
Right, I think one or two.
This is extraordinary. I mean, let's just objectively, this is an extraordinary political achievement for Nancy Pelosi. How did that happen? How did she do that?
Well, I think things got a little off the rails at the start with the Judiciary Committee, and they kind of moved that over to Schiff, and he did it, I think, a pretty bang-up job. I think everyone would agree that it was pretty tightly run, and the report they produced was pretty top-notch work. I think maybe if this went on longer, though, you might lose some, right? I think you kind of answered your own question there, because the way they're doing this now is going to afford them almost zero defections. And as you say, rightly, the pundits were way out ahead of themselves on this one, predicting big losses or at least moderately sized losses. And it didn't happen. She's good at this stuff, right? I mean, there are a lot of things you
could
disagree
very good at this
with
stuff.
Her on the substance. Or she really, I mean, you could disagree with her on the substance. I mean, in a very big picture sense, I agree with you completely. We can't really have a real reckoning into this scandal without a much deeper dive, right? One thing that sort of frustrates me about how this whole thing is talked about is that we don't really talk about it as a scandal that involves multiple cabinet members and large swaths of the government, all of which were pressed into service for this whole thing. William Barr traveling the world to make the Ukraine 2016 conspiracy theories true. Pompeo essentially putting the State Department at the disposal of Trump's reelection campaign, being directly involved in this pressure campaign to remove his own ambassadors.
Amazing.
It's crazy stuff. And this is just the foreign policy of the United States being completely subverted to Trump's political needs. And Mulvaney freezing the aid, right? And all sorts of OMD people being involved in that. The DNI trying to prevent the whistleblower complaint from being transmitted to Congress, DOJ advising against that transmission, DOJ refusing to open an investigation when a CIA counsel, senior counsel at CIA, made a criminal referral. Huge thing on a multi-tentacled scandal involving multiple cabinet members and top aides. And yes, we can't have a full reckoning unless we get to the bottom of all of it, but I don't know that we can get it.
Okay, so let's go back to Susan Collins a bit. You know, you found this 1999 tape where she's saying exactly the opposite of what she's saying now about witnesses. But you could actually do this with almost every member of the Senate, can't you? Both Democrats and Republicans are taking exactly the opposite positions that they took in the Clinton impeachment. I mean, this is like an Olympics of hypocrisy, won't it be?
Well, I think if you were to look back at what some of the Democrats were saying, I believe Jonathan Chait did a pretty deep dive into this, and it probably is worth pulling up. He went through what a number of the Democrats were saying, and I don't think they were the equivalent of what we're seeing from Republicans now. It's true that they imposed impeachment, but they didn't just pretend that the conduct was okay. There was a lot of criticism of Bill Clinton, including on the legal stuff. Whereas what we're seeing from Republicans right now, I mean, a good exercise is to ask yourself how many Republicans have publicly said that there is any problem with anything Trump mm-hmm. did at any point.
Yeah.
Now, I think there are a few, right? Romney, I believe a couple of the moderates expressed some concern about this or that, but the enormous bulk of Republicans have taken the stance either that the corrupt conduct that is on record in the transcript that the White House itself put out didn't happen at all, or is just fine. He was just concerned about corruption.
And it will be interesting to see how far they go, you know, particularly, you know, as Rudy Giuliani keeps spinning out more and more bizarre conspiracy theories in coordination with the White House. It is hard to keep up. OK, so on this issue of the trial, you wrote about this yesterday. Overwhelmingly, Americans think that Trump should allow his top aides to testify. 71%, right? 72% of independents. And then you write about the way that you mentioned Susan Collins before, but also Joni Ernst. Are kind of road testing their arguments about the trial. You say these their arguments are so spectacularly disingenuous that you can almost picture them snickering at their own bad faith as they rehearse them in the mirror. So what is Joni Ernst and Susan Collins? What are they trying to push right now?
Well, I mean, the problem that they face right now is that Mitch McConnell gave away the game.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that his appearance on Hannity really was properly and widely criticized. It's just an amazing thing to hear from the majority leader to be. I just want to back up for a second, if I can.
Sure.
One thing that really was striking to me about McConnell's appearance on Hannity was that he appeared to be, if you listen closely, it sounded the way he kept repeating that he was doing this. Everything would be done in full and absolute consultation with the White House counsel. There would be no daylight between them whatsoever.
It was like on a loop. He kept repeating it. Yeah.
Yes. And it sounded to me like he was reassuring Trump voters of this.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was really striking. Like, is that his role, to reassure Trump voters that the interests of the Republican Senate and the president are 100% in alignment?
Was he afraid that Trump was going to release the trolls and the flying monkeys against him? That, you know, Mitch McConnell needs to stand up and be firm for our president, that sort of thing?
So he did that, right, for a while?
Yeah.
Remember there was, I think there was a period, you probably remember this better than I do, I think it was maybe a few months ago, but Trump was being quite public about his dissatisfaction with Senate Republicans and House Republicans for not fighting hard enough.
Yeah, they beat up on Lindsey Graham, and it took about 48 hours for Lindsey Graham to fold. That's not a surprise anymore. So, that was an extraordinary thing, and I did think that was one of those moments where everything has become normalized, but you step back and you realize, number one, really what Mitch McConnell just said, and then, of course, Lindsey Graham basically saying that, I'm not only have made up my mind, I'm going to do everything possible to basically turn this into a complete, you know, sham.
Now, right, if I'm one of you guys on the center-right who's still trying to get Republicans to behave like a responsible and an actor in a democracy, which it seems to me that you guys are really preoccupied with, and you know, one reason we like what you guys do so much. I look at that and I think, Jesus Christ, what Lindsey Graham is essentially showing there is that the Republican and Trump base, I hate to use those interchangeably, I know they're not quite the same thing.
They're close, though.
Yeah, they're getting closer, right? So the Republican base, I watch Lindsey Graham say that kind of thing, and what I come away from it with is that they now think that this is what the Republican base requires, right? They think that sticking a middle finger in the face of the process and just tearing it to shreds and essentially saying we'll do whatever it takes. Because and then using an invented series of things about Democrats to justify it, they think this is what is now what the Republican base wants to see. And if I'm you, if I'm the I guess the center right resistance, I'm thinking, how do we get back from this? I mean, how do you get back from
Yeah,
this?
well, it will require somebody to stand up and push back and then survive. I mean, I think that's literally what has to happen. But it is interesting. You make a very interesting point here that they expect that the base demands absolute fealties. And so they're assuming that you cannot get away with standing up and saying that the president's conduct is unacceptable or a threat, but not perhaps impeachable or removable.
Right,
That
exactly.
that's why the possibility of censure is absolutely closed, because in Trump world, anything short of this man is absolutely perfect. He's restoring America's dream is not acceptable. So going back to the Collins and Ernst position, Collins. Reaction was, after Chuck Schumer stepped up and said, no, we should have witnesses, she said, I was surprised that he didn't first sit down with a Senate majority leader and discuss his proposals rather than doing a letter that he released to the press. The more constructive way would have been for him to sit down with Senator McConnell. And as you point out, it was McConnell who went public first. I mean, he's the one who went on Sean Hannity.
Right.
And
And he went out there and he literally told us that he is going to that he essentially if Susan Collins wants to see constructive negotiating between McConnell and Schumer, she should be absolutely dismayed by what McConnell did, because McConnell clarified unequivocally that any such negotiations will be subservient to what Trump wants to do and to the fact that Republican Senate interests and Trump's interests are in 100% alignment.
yeah, and Joni Ernst is saying, we're good here. We don't need the witnesses. If the House wanted to do more, they could have done more. We don't need to clean up their sloppy job.
Right, and of course, the White House blocked all those witnesses. So there's a level of bad faith and disingenuousness here that's really, really hard to know what to do about. By the way, one just to amplify your point about them expecting Trump to be treated as perfect. Remember that he's been tweeting over and over in capital letters and not in capital letters. Read the transcript. My theory for a long time now has been that what he means by that is, hey, Republicans, defend what I'm doing. It's fine, right?
I think he's very explicit about that. He does
Yeah.
not. He actually didn't he tweet a few weeks ago basically saying, enough of this Republicans, saying that it's wrong but not impeachable. No, it was perfect. The call was perfect.
Exactly.
You must say this. And that is the line. So we do seem to be headed toward an impeachment vote where there's a pot. The over under might be 0.5 Republican votes for removal. Are you more optimistic?
No, not really. Not really. I think it's absolutely plausible that you see zero.
Ooh, that, I've gotten used to disappointment and disillusionment, but if Mitt Romney votes, that would be like, okay,
Oh,
just
that's a
kind
good
of freak.
point. Yeah, well, what do you
Yeah.
guys think? I mean, what's
No.
the view from the view from the center right resistance?
Well, the view from the center right resistance is you would hope I'm looking for people who are more optimistic than I am because I tend to depress parties. But I was just watching Mitt Romney's comments this afternoon, on impeachment eve, and they were not reassuring. Okay, so since I have you on, I just wanted to bounce another idea, a question off you. How con this is like not an impeachment question directly. How concerned should Democrats be with the model of the British election, watching the Labour Party absolutely decimated and the mass exodus of white working class voters from the Labour Party? Is that a legitimate, I mean, is it legitimate to say this is a warning to Democrats about the danger of this cultural political moment we are in, the danger of moving too far left?
I don't know, and I mean that sincerely. I mean, one thing that makes it not a really useful parallel is that the white working class exodus from the Democratic Party is far ahead of that already, right? Hillary Clinton got, I believe, in the 20s. Mm-hmm. Is that right? If that's
really?
Wrong, maybe you got. Yeah,
no.
I think it was in mm-hmm. the. I think it was in the high 20s. But it, maybe if that's wrong.
So you're saying they're already gone.
Yeah, I mean, and I think Obama was able to win them back through. But people often point out that Obama, there's this thing called the Obama-Trump voter, and that Obama did better with working class whites, particularly in the Rust Belt, than Hillary Clinton did. There are a couple reasons why I think that argument needs to be sort of looked at a little bit skeptically. One is that Obama was elected under really truly extraordinary mm-hmm. circumstances, right? You had two terms of a Republican president who by the end was very unpopular, I think much more unpopular than we can even imagine a president being now, right? A very unpopular war with at that point thousands dead, and the worst financial crisis in 70 years. And then so after that, right, of course he was going to do far better among working class whites in those circumstances than a Democrat ordinarily would. But even so, he didn't do very well, right? And then in 2012, he had the fortune of running against Romney, who demographically is sort of perfectly suited to be able to poach union members in the Midwest, right? And of course they did that. They were incredibly targeted with their work on that stuff, which by the way is an untold story. Like, I remember them telling me, we're going after Northern Ohio working class whites in a way that we're not going after Southern Ohio working class whites. And that was very impressive to me. And of course they won Ohio, right? Which is now sort of unthinkable for a Democrat, although maybe Biden
isn't that
could
something
do
that happened pretty quickly. So you share my obsession, of course, with Wisconsin, and I'm sitting here in Wisconsin right now, and the convention will be in Milwaukee. And I had this flash this afternoon, you know, of trying to think about how this convention is going to play in Wisconsin. And I don't know, this is kind of random, I'm sorry. I'm just imagining the Democrats not being able to restrain themselves from having lengthy debates and controversies over which, you know, gender appropriate pronouns to use, and long speeches about the need to confront white supremacy and white privilege in a state that is overwhelmingly white, in which people are going to go, okay, we get the how loathsome Donald Trump is, but they will be rolling their eyes at this. It's but the Democrats. Can the Democrats restrain themselves from playing those cultural issues that have driven the kinds of voters who will determine who wins Wisconsin away?
Well, I think that's a really good question, and it's a complicated one. And
it's
loaded, I'm going to try to come at it from a bunch of different angles. Hillary Clinton lost Wisconsin by, you would know the number better than I, but a tiny
23,000.
Right. And remember, she had a Muslim Muslim American on the stage at the convention, and they really went pretty hard into that type of identity politics that you're talking about, and she even gave a speech about race and so forth. And I think now, given that happened and Hillary was also a woman, I don't know. It seems to me that Wisconsin is, and you would know this better than I, but you can get there by just bumping up that suburban and minority vote share and turnout too, as long as you just keep the margins from getting completely out of control in rural Wisconsin, right?
And that's the test. You can add another 20,000 votes, another 40,000 votes in Milwaukee County. Madison and Dane County is pretty much maxed out. So the question is the hemorrhaging done in rural Wisconsin? And also, are you going to see the continuing erosion of support in the suburbs? Because here in Wisconsin, the beating heart of the Republican Party for years was the WOW counties, Waukesha, Ozaukee, Washington counties. These are the counties that are right around Milwaukee County.
Right.
And if, in fact, this national trend continues, you have and Trump underperforms, big Democratic turnout, and hold their own rural, yes, Democrat can win Wisconsin, But you just don't know whether or not that, and you've talked about this with the Democrats here, whether or not there are still more, you know, non-voters that Trump can bring out.
Right, and I think that's a real concern, and it's one that they're very serious about. And I would, one thing I'd point out is that I don't know if this quite answers the identity politics question you raised, but they really are trying to get the balance right. I mean, they are knocking on every single door that they can in Milwaukee right now, right? And they're trying to show up in every rural county too, right? So they're acutely aware of the need to both push up the turnout and vote share in Milwaukee and the suburbs, while also doing everything they can not to let those rural counties get away from them in an even worse fashion. So, you know, so I think that sort of speaks to your question in a way, right? They understand that they can't become the party that's too oriented towards young voters and minorities, right? But at the same time, go ahead.
Well, actually, see, it's actually more complicated. I mean, let's face it, African Americans are quite socially conservative. And so you have the race issue, but then you also have this sort of, you know, cultural disconnect, which is hard for me to, you know, capsulize in a sentence, except to say the, you know, sort of obnoxious wokeness that plays extremely badly in central Wisconsin.
Well, I'll tell you one thing that's interesting about that is if you think about the four leading Democrats, right, none of them really is associated with that type of woke politics, really, right? Bernie certainly is not. He's an old line social Democrat, right? Elizabeth Warren, maybe, but she's really much more focused on issues involving corporate governance, and she's not even that focused on Medicare for All, as you may have noticed recently, right?
Well, it's not which is helping her, yeah.
Right, and that's true, and she spots that. Biden and Buttigieg seem to me to not be quite in that camp either. So, I don't know.
Yeah,
I think a lot will turn on who the nominee is.
I think it is. Are you surprised by how resilient Joe Biden has turned out to be? I mean, he's taken everything and he's still chugging along. 77 years old, he's still leading the pack.
Yeah, it's pretty extraordinary what was thrown at him. I mean, and let's face it, his self-inflicted wounds were also pretty extraordinary. Yet he seems to have been able to rebound. I think he's clearly got a real possibility. One thing that's sort of interesting to contemplate is if Mayor Pete kind of muddles the picture in the early primary states, maybe with a really strong showing in Iowa and New Hampshire, maybe winning one or both, right? It could sort of create the impression that neither of the two progressives has emerged as the leading alternative to Biden, which enables Biden to come back in South Carolina, maybe even after coming in third or something. And right. If the picture is muddled coming out of those early primary states, and you don't get the sense that either Warren or Sanders has emerged as the clear alternative to Biden, I think he's got a shot to sort of stay in it, even if he doesn't do as well as he hopes in those two first states.
Okay, I know you're very, very busy, but one last question here. Is Joe Biden on balance? How has he been affected by the impeachment debate? I mean, every day it's Joe Biden, Hunter Biden, all of this stuff. Does this help him? Does this cause Democrats to rally around? Is it going to damage him? What is your sense about how this debate about digging up dirt on Biden has affected Biden's presidential campaign?
Well, I worry about that. I mean, we saw what happened with Hillary in the emails. I think that's certainly a cautionary thing, right? But one thing that's sort of interesting to note is that in a certain sense, the impeachment debate plays in Biden's favor and maybe not in such an obvious way. Biden has been the guy who structured his entire campaign more forcefully than any other candidate around the idea that Trump is a uniquely threatening and damaging figure to American political culture and the identity of the country, right, than any other. And so to the degree that we're all talking about what a threat Trump represents to in every which way, he's really been the guy who's been saying, I'm the guy to defeat this threat. And I think that might be, to return to your other point, I think that's one reason maybe he's been resilient. right? Among Democratic
voters. And other Democrats, is there a reluctance to attack him because he is under attack in this particular way? I mean, I'm looking at, you're more familiar with this than I am, but the attacks against Pete Buttigieg seem to be much more intense than the attacks against Joe Biden. Has this created kind of a force field around him, at least within Democratic circles?
Well, I mean, if you think about what Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders are trying to do, attacking Hunter Biden isn't really quite the way to get the sort of support that they want, right? Right. They're making it, their primary argument is that, and although they don't even say this explicitly, which maybe, or at least as explicitly as they could, which maybe supports your point, but their general argument is mainly that Biden is a creature of a type of Democratic establishment that's too allied with Wall Street to affect real economic and political change. And so if they start talking about Hunter Biden, I don't see how it really moves that message for them, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I guess there might be a way to say something like, oh, you know, this is Washington corruption as usual. But it feels to me like, look what happened when early on in the primary process, this is ancient history already, but the criticism of Obama's presidency was much more scathing at the outset, if you recall,
right,
than it has been much more recently.
Yes,
it went away pretty quickly. It was really pretty remarkable how the Democrats and who did that quickly shifted when they got hit by the backlash from it. So, I mean, Biden, you know, is still a pretty popular figure, and going at him personally, I think would be hard to do that and without alienating a lot of Democratic voters. And Bernie wants some of Biden's more working class supporters, right? And they all want to try and win his African-American support, and African-Americans associate Biden to some degree with Obama. Sure. And so personal attacks on Biden would seem to not get them where they need to go.
Greg Sargent, thank you so much for spending so much time with us. The author of your column is called The Plumb Line.
Yeah, that's right.
It is The Plumb Line in The Washington Post. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast on this impeachment day. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.